Everyone loves a rogue, and in the long tradition of movie rogues, Han Solo is one of the most popular. The Star Wars star gets his own origin tale in Solo, a Star Wars story, a standalone film that sits adjacent to George Lucas's main storyline. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Nathan Weinbinder and I will discuss this new Star Wars feature. Plus, Nathan will continue sharing his experiences at the 44th Seattle International Film Festival. So don't touch that dial, because Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
When the news is good, it's good to hear. When the news is bad, it's essential to hear. You can depend on Spokane Public Radio to tell you what's going on, why it's happening, and to try to make sense of what it all means. People who are members of Spokane Public Radio, just like you, make this service possible. Thank you for doing your part.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that is still missing its favorite rogue, Mary Pat Truthart, who is at this very moment likely eating some gelato on the streets of Florence, Italy. Speaking of rogues, though, one of the main characters in the George Lucas Star Wars universe is one of the most enduring mavericks in Hollywood history. I'm speaking, of course, about the self-styled space outlaw Han Solo, whose origins are explored in the new film Solo, a Star Wars Story. Nathan and I are going to debate the virtues of Solo, and then Nathan is going to continue his coverage of the 44th Seattle International Film Festival, talking about what he's seen and what, if you have time, you should take the time to check out yourself. Let's begin by heading back once again to a time long ago in a galaxy far, far away. Every great story needs an iconoclast, a character who steps to the beat of a different drummer, and who has, deep inside, a good heart that is often masked by a gruff exterior and a penchant for sarcastic asides. Think of Rhett Butler. Think of Philip Marlowe. Think of Mia Wallace. In that vein, give George Lucas credit for, amid all the mythos that colors his Star Wars universe, creating one of the great sci-fi rogues of all time in Han Solo. The yang to Luke Skywalker's yin, Han is the most watchable character, other than the two robots and maybe Darth Vader, in Lucas's original three movies. Now in Solo, a Star Wars Story, director Ron Howard, with a nod to the efforts of Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, not to mention screenwriters Jonathan and Lawrence Kasdan, gives us Han's origin story, his escape from the planet Corellia, his separation from his first love, Kira, his meeting with the Wookiee, Chewbacca, his relationship with the space pirate Tobias Beckett, and their struggle with Dryden Voss and the criminal organization Crimson Dawn. All of this, which features various differences from the Star Wars histories you can find online, is explored in an energetic manner that is straightforward, and despite all the negative pre-release publicity, the firing of original directors Lord and Miller to be specific, refreshingly entertaining. The most surprising thing? Alden Ehrenreich doesn't do a spot-on impression of Harrison Ford's Han, but he does manage to bring his own feel for such a classic character. And like the movies itself, it does justice to the source material.
Well, this is an interesting proposition because it's the second live-action theatrical release that's about an already established character. I mean, Han Solo is one of the most famous movie characters of all time.
Right.
I was thinking about this as I was watching it, that he might be the most influential movie hero. And I would put Indiana Jones in there, too.
Exactly.
Just Harrison Ford's just kind of late 70s, early 80s output. One of the most influential characters in modern cinema. I mean, I don't think we would have had Bill Murray in Ghostbusters or Jack Sparrow in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies or Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark or Peter Quill in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, because there were swashbucklers before Han Solo, obviously. But Harrison,
Errol Flynn. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But Harrison Valentino. But but Harrison Ford had this way of channeling those guys, but also making you feel like, one, he was kind of over it, and two, he wasn't afraid to look dumb. And he often looked very dumb in those movies.
Yes.
And that's kind of the beauty of Han Solo. Solo. So it's interesting that we're getting this now. It's also the first Star Wars movie to be directed by somebody like Ron Howard, somebody who hasn't made a Star Wars movie before, who has a huge output, has made a lot of critically and commercially successful blockbuster films.
He's got a couple of Oscars.
Yeah, so it just this idea is interesting. And I love Han Solo, don't get me wrong. He's probably my favorite Star Wars character. But the entire time I was watching Solo, I just kept thinking, why am I not involved in this? And I think it's because there were really no risks taken in this movie. It's a very, very safe film. And it was entertaining in the sense that I like battles in space, but I kind of wanted this to be more. And as you said, we learn a lot of things. Well, actually, no, we don't learn anything about Han Solo. We just see the things that have happened to him that we've been told about.
Right.
So we find out where he got his name. We find out how he got the Millennium Falcon. We see how he met Chewbacca, how he met Lando Calrissian.
Although that's one of the differences that you look back online in the history, and it's really different.
So. I don't care about any of that. And then you see him make the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs. We actually see that. And in theory, you round down, obviously.
Yes.
But in theory, I love all of that. And yet this movie didn't have that kind of swashbuckling swagger that I kind of wanted it to. And obviously, young Han Solo isn't going to have the same swagger that Harrison Ford Han Solo is going to have. And I think Alden Ehrenreich is perfectly fine. We've seen him be better in movies like the Coen brothers' Hail Caesar, where he really broke out.
Yep.
And I do wonder what Lord and Miller's version of this story would have been, because in the past, they've taken these pop culture properties that should not have worked and have really made gold out of them. I mean, we're talking
the Lego movie,
the 21 Jump Street movies.
Right.
I mean, those are films that I was not expecting to love as much as I did. And so I was really excited when they signed on for this. And supposedly, I mean, you kind of have to talk about the behind-the-scenes fracas that birthed Solo.
Right, the so-called creative differences.
Yes.
That they were 5 months into production.
So it makes me wonder how much of the footage we see is from them, if any. But I found it funny that supposedly Kathleen Kennedy, obviously big producer at Lucasfilm, did not like that Lord and Miller were indebted to improv. That was apparently something she really didn't like. So I found it really funny that one of the plans in the film proper is no improvisation. And I thought maybe she's sending a message to them through these characters. So
they were also apparently not doing as many setups that Lucasfilm wanted, so that they were trying to ensure that their vision of the film got out. I mean, a big studio likes to have so many setups so they can craft the final product any way they want.
There's echoes here of Edgar Wright and his Ant-Man film when he got fired by Marvel. And like that movie, I keep thinking about the film that could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a hurdle I need to get over. But the final product we get here, Solo, A Star Wars Story, is fine. It's okay. It's perfectly serviceable as kind of a Saturday matinee sort of thing. But this is not a movie that is going to stick with me for, I mean, I just saw it like an hour ago.
Yeah.
And it's already kind of fading from memory. It's okay. I want Star Wars movies to be more special than this.
as Mary Pat would say, specialer. Yes, exactly. To me, it was fine just as it is. I mean, it delivers. It has plenty of action. It goes from the very beginning, wham, 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 wham. It's kind of like the lesser of the Indiana Jones movies. I mean, nothing ever beats the original Indiana Jones movies. It's one of the lesser ones. But still, even so, you can enjoy those just simply for what they are. I made this point in a couple of recent programs and a couple of reviews I've written. I'm really, really tired of this larger mythology, this larger mythos, and that these things are bigger than real life. They're cartoon movies. You know, let's go back to when Gene Autry was underneath the earth and finding the fairy queens.
Well, let's not go that far.
Well, maybe not that far, but let's go back to Indiana Jones.
Sure.
Let's go back to the, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
But here's the thing. You know, I think comparing this to a lesser Indiana Jones movie is actually apt. At the same time, those, even the lesser Indiana Jones movies, maybe not the fourth one, but the second and third one certainly, even though they're not to the level of Raiders, they at least have individual action set pieces that are stunning and exciting and electric.
Yeah.
And this doesn't really have that.
No.
I mean, Ron Howard knows what he's doing, obviously, but there were really no moments in this where I was really swept away, where I was excited. And going back to the last Star Wars standalone, which was Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, which I wasn't a huge fan of, that movie at least had some guts and it took some narrative risks.
Yes.
I thought that the first two thirds were, I was kind of thinking, well, what's the point of all this? And then the last third is actually a pretty daring movie. movie compared to what these kinds of movies normally do. Mm-hmm. And obviously, this can only go so far because we know that half of these characters can't die by the end of this movie. So we sort of know where it's going. But I wanted it to do something more than it does. I mean, it's like a solid B minus, but I want a Han Solo movie to be better than a B minus. Mm. All of the pieces seem to be there. I mean, Aaron Reich looks the part. I really love Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian. You could not have picked somebody better to play Lando Calrissian. And yet they don't really give him anything to do. I mean, he gets a couple moments and he's kind of channeling Billy Dee Williams. He's cooler than everyone else on screen.
Well, there's a chance he may have his own movie.
And I would like that because he doesn't really get a chance to break through. And we know from seeing Donald Glover and other things that he absolutely can, that he can command a scene and steal the focus from everybody else.
Right.
And he doesn't get a chance to do that.
And if they do give him his own movie, they should let him write it because
Yes. And another thing, I think that this movie is deliberately channeling the kind of 70s era visual palette that the original ones had. So, I mean, it's a very limited color palette. There's lots of beiges and yellows and browns and occasionally a red, but nothing too bright. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this off mic, but I think the screening I saw, the projection was a little bit dim, so that didn't help. But I thought that for a Star Wars movie, this was a pretty visually, not unpleasant, but nothing popped visually. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that way too? Or were you not paying attention?
I saw it in a different theater and it was brighter. I don't know. I was just so wrapped up in the action that it didn't bother me one way or another.
Another thing I keep saying.
I mean,
it's a serviceable movie.
Is it a great movie? No. But it's perfectly serviceable summer movie.
I think the bar is higher than that for these kinds of movies that I don't know if we should be giving it a pass like this. But I want to say another thing. We talked about Deadpool 2 last week and killing off a character that you think is going to be important very early on. Solo does that too with an actor who I really like and was excited to see in a Star Wars movie. And they kill this character off and you think it's going to be a big deal. And then that character never comes up again. And I kept thinking, why did that have to happen? And the whole movie kind of feels like that to me, where the stakes are very low, yet the whole way through we're told the stakes are very high. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, this just felt like, what's the word? They're basically waiting to get to the next one, I suppose.
That's right. Well,
marking time.
I enjoyed it much more than I did Avengers Infinity War. Yes.
No, that was more fun than this.
Oh, no.
Yes. Yes.
Neither of them are as good as Black Panther.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yes. Yeah. Okay. Or even like Wonder Woman.
Yeah. So let's end with an agreement.
Okay.
That was Solo, a Star Wars story. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to hear Nathan talk more about the 2018 Seattle International Film Festival. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I discussed Solo, a Star Wars story, and I was correct. Let's now turn to a more regional film event, the 44th Seattle International Film Festival. Nathan, school us on what you've seen and what we need to put on our respective viewing menus.
I sure can. And we should also say that this is the last weekend of the Seattle International Film Festival.
If you're listening to this
on
Friday night, yeah, you got time to go over.
Yeah, so June 10th is the final day, and there's still plenty of stuff to see. If you go to SIFF.net, you can see the entire calendar. And if you've never been, you absolutely should check it out at some point if you have the means to go over.
Yeah.
And if you're over there already,
Yep.
Go check out some movies. So I'm going to start with one of the movies that I liked the best of the week that I was over there, and it's called Leave No Trace. And this is the newest film from Deborah Granik, who broke out in the indie movie scene in 2010 with a movie called Winter's Bone.
And made Jennifer Lawrence a star.
Yeah, Jennifer Lawrence got her first Oscar nomination for that movie. It was the first time that we all thought, who is that?
Yeah, yeah.
And when can I see her in another movie? Mm-hmm. And now she's one of the biggest stars on the planet.
Right.
And Winter's Bone was that movie. It was set in the Ozarks. It was super gritty and violent
John
and
Hawks
depressing.
Was in it. Yeah.
John Hawks also got an Oscar nomination for that movie. And Leave No Trace, which is Granik's first narrative feature since, so it's been 8 years since she's made a movie, has a lot in common with Winter's Bone, except it's set in the Pacific Northwest, the forests of Portland specifically. And it's also about people living on the fringes and living off the land and about how that can be a pretty grim existence if you let it get to you. The only difference is that while Winter's Bone was a gritty, R-rated, dark, almost grindhouse kind of movie with an art house veneer on it.
Yeah.
Leave No Trace is a much gentler film. It's got a PG rating, which is
With a Ben Foster rating?
Yeah, yeah. It's very, very rare for a movie. And I hesitate to say it's a family film, but it certainly could
be.
It's
a
movie
about
families,
yeah.
Yes. It's got Ben Foster in it. And every time we see Ben Foster, we always think, okay, what kind of psychopath is he playing this time?
Exactly.
And he and his daughter live off the land in the forests of Portland. And they're kind
of a public park, right?
Yeah, they're moving from one encampment to another. We see their day-to-day lives in these unadorned, almost verite-style shots. And they seem to be doing fine. We don't know much about them before the movie starts, except we know that her mother has died and they've been living this way for as long as she can remember. And they're constantly studying evasion tactics and figuring out, okay, well, what can we do to be sure that we avoid detection for as long as possible, even though there are forest rangers nearby that are cutting down trees and they're always just out of sight. Well, about a half hour, 45 minutes into the movie, they are caught. Maybe it's shorter than that. Your mind is kind of off. Your internal clock is shot when you're at a film festival. But early into the movie, they're discovered and they basically have to reintegrate themselves into society. And what you have to understand about the Ben Foster character here is that he doesn't want to reintegrate into society, even though he has a really great support system helping him and his young daughter. I think she's maybe 12 or 13. Helping them out, trying to find them a home that they can live in for a short amount of time, getting him a job, getting her into school. The movie goes from there and you learn more about them. You understand their relationship. You meet all of these other characters that are in a similar circumstance where they're sort of living off the grid and trying to make do as a community. What I really love about this movie, which again is called Leave No Trace, is that it has all of the pieces of a really grating, melodramatic
A Lifetime movie.
Absolutely. And it never goes that direction. And it's because of these two central performances and because Granik, as a filmmaker, has a lot of confidence in her material, in her actors, and in us as an audience to not need everything explained to us, to not need everything telegraphed before it's going to happen. And it all ends with a really heartbreaking scene between the father and daughter that I wouldn't dream of spoiling, but I think a lot of other filmmakers would have bungled this moment because it's the moment that everything really hinges on. And if it doesn't work, your whole movie doesn't work.
Right.
And it really, really works. So I know that one has a distribution deal and it should be coming out. It may get awards buzz. I don't know when exactly it's coming out, but it's called Leave No Trace. And I think it's really terrific. It's one of the best things I saw at SIFF. And sort of a nice bit of synergy here, another movie I saw that's also about a 13-year-old girl living on the fringes in the Pacific Northwest is called Sadie. It's the newest film from director Megan Griffiths, who is based out of Seattle, actually. It's about this young girl. It's set during the Iraq War, so early 2000s. Her name is Sadie, and she's sort of rebelling against, well, everything, I suppose. She's waiting for her dad to come back from the war, even though he's been gone much longer than he probably needed to be. He keeps extending his leave, but she keeps waiting for him. And she's living with her mother, played by Melanie Lynskey, who I always like when Melanie Lynskey shows up and stuff, because she's always good.
Yep.
And Melanie Lynskey has moved on. she has essentially started living as a single parent, even though she's technically still married. And she starts seeing a new guy that moves into the trailer park, played by John Gallagher Jr. And it's the first real relationship that she's had in a long time, even though he's got some troubling things going on. And it seems like it's going to be a pretty standard adolescent coming of age, oh, I have to warm up to this new father figure kind of movie. But Griffiths takes it in a much darker direction than I expected. Sadie says and does things that are not normal for a 13-year-old girl to say and do. And you realize that this is a seriously troubled kid and that she needs more help than you initially think. And I've read some reviews of this movie, which again is called Sadie, that did not buy where the movie ends up. But I went with it, and it's maybe a bit too much where the movie finally goes. But I was with it because I think the performances are really solid. And I thought that the setting, this rainy, verdant trailer park, really came
along.
John
Gallagher Jr. was in Short Term 12, correct?
Correct, yeah. And on The Newsroom, and he was in 10 Cloverfield Lane. He's really good. So that's called Sadie. The next movie I want to talk about also features John Gallagher Jr.
Oh,
really? What a segue. Mm-hmm. And it was called The Miseducation of Cameron Post. And this movie already has a lot of buzz around it because it won the jury prize at the most recent Sundance Film Festival. And the interesting thing about the Sundance Jury Prize is that sometimes the movies that win go on to do great things. Whiplash has won it, Fruitvale Station, Precious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Other times you get something like Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. Did anyone see that?
Right.
And so this movie won the jury prize, and I'll be really curious to see where it goes from here because it could either take off and become a big indie crossover hit or it could crash and burn. It's set in the early 90s, and it stars Chloe Grace Moretz, who I think is a really underrated young actress, as a closeted gay teenager who is living in this broken but very evangelical home. And she is caught with one of her female classmates and is set off to a gay conversion camp.
Yeah.
It's called God's Promise. And John Gallagher Jr. is one of the counselors there. He has fought against what they call his same-sex attraction. They keep saying that over and over again, same-sex attraction. And the movie follows the kind of narrative structure that you would expect from a Sundance movie. You have seen this movie before in terms of its basic nuts and bolts. And it's based on a young adult novel, so that probably has a lot to do with it too. But what I liked about this movie, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, is that the characters in it are very vivid. Sasha Lane, who was the star of Andrea Arnold's American Honey, is in this as well, and she's really good. It has a lot in common with Short Term 12, actually, in that all of the pieces really should not click together, and some of the pieces don't click together, and everything builds to one traumatic moment that changes everything, and then there's a sense of release after that. You know where everything is going, essentially. But the characters here are really good. The performances are really good. The dialogue is sharp. It's based on a young adult novel. I think teenagers would get a lot out of it. It is rated R because it's not namby-pamby about any of this stuff. There
Wait
is sexuality. There is language.
A movie starring Ben Foster is PG.
Yes.
And this one with Chloe Grace Moretz is R.
Listen, we're in the upside down right now.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I know this movie has a distribution deal. I believe it's coming out sometime in August or September. Again, I wonder how this is going to land with mainstream audiences, but I think older teenagers could get a lot out of it. And they probably won't have seen a lot of the indie films that we have, so maybe it'll be fresh to them. But again, it's called The Miseducation of Cameron Post.
So we're almost out of time here. So overall, what was your take on the festival, your experience?
I saw a lot of good stuff. I saw some stuff I didn't like so much.
But that's the way festivals go, yeah.
I also was telling Dan off mic, half of the movies I saw were directed by women, which is a total change of pace from what film festivals usually are.
Refreshing change of pace.
And I'd like to see more of that. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. That was our wrap-up of the 2018 Seattle International Film Festival. This, of course, is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I discussed Solo, A Star Wars Story. Let's thank Jim Tavenin for both producing and engineering the show. In the same breath, let's thank you two, our loyal listeners, whom we invite back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, when we'll again explore the universe of contemporary cinema. Until then, remember this quote from the novelist Peter S. Beagle: great heroes need great sorrows and burdens, or half their greatness goes unnoticed. It is all part of the fairy tale. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.